Hello and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week, I meet Chris Smith, whose medieval thriller Black Death stars Sean Bean fending off the plague. Director Barney Platt-Mills goes back to 1970 to talk about his lost London classic, Bronco Bullfrog, an urban romance set in the old East End, returning to the big screen. And Zan Brooks joins me to review some of this week's other releases, including Greenberg with Ben Stiller and Rhys Ifans, British documentary Shed Your Tears and Walk Away, Brooklyn's Finest, a cop thriller with Richard Gere and Ethan Hawke, and H2 Oil, about Canada's tar sands. Yes, it's got big thrills, yet no oil spills. It's Film Weekly. Making your career as a British genre director is a brave move indeed. Director Chris Smith made his first splash with the London Underground horror Creep, and he's continued on a path of gory, with Severance in 2006 and last year's J-horror-inspired Triangle, in which a yacht trip turned nightmarish. With the film Black Death, Smith has now entered into the territory of medieval thriller. It stars Sean Bean as Ulrich, a mercenary knight who accompanies a monk, played by Eddie Redmayne, to find a mysterious village that seems to have gained immunity from the virus, but in doing so has aroused the hatred of the bishop.
Do you truly believe this village can raise their dead?
I would not be here otherwise. You doubt it?
I believe that hunting necromancers and demons serves men more than it serves God.
You have learned much, nestled inside a monastery. Demons and necromancers are among us. As you will find out soon enough.
And I'm glad to say that we have risen from the dead. The director, Chris Smith, to join me in the Film Weekly series. You weren't dead. I mean, Severance, Creep, and that's rude about Triangle. Did very well on DVD. Chris, it's really nice to see you. Welcome to Film Weekly. I really enjoyed Black Death. I have to say that it kind of, we do see you as a genre director in some kind of way, but this is a genre all of its own, the medieval thriller. What kind of inspired you to go back to the 1348 and all that?
Yeah, I just thought the period was really interesting. I mean, it was a period where, you know, the Black Death killed half the population of Europe, and they had one of two ideas of what had caused it. Either it was sent by the devil to punish people and torment people, or it was sent by God to punish you for your sins. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to, if that's the mindset, to send some guys off into that world? So.
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me of, you know, those kind of slightly classics, I suppose, The Wicker Man, Witchfinder General. There must have been a sort of penchant for these things back in the 70s that you're sort of re-channeling.
Yeah, I mean, Witchfinder General I'm a big fan of that movie. And I also looked at the film for this one, the Werner Herzog film, Aguirre, Wrath of God.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, weirdly, till Tim McInerney is holding a knife up and doing a little poem saying, blood of our blood, and just about to kill someone, that I realised they had so many echoes of The Wicker Man as well. But The Wicker Man's kind of is just a coincidence in a way.
Oh, really? Yeah, it just seeps into it. Well, every time I see flaxen-haired wenches and comely
exactly.
maids, I'm thinking of Wicker Man.
I was thinking of there was thought of having them, you know, trailing around, you know, carrying little flags and stuff, and I just tried to keep it as serious as possible.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it is, because it's quite a serious film. I was thinking at any moment it's going, well, obviously one's kind of a little snigger away from being a Blackadder, because your lead, Eddie Redmayne, who's a terrific actor, I think he's been on the show before. He plays Osmond, it's not Edmund, and you've got Ulrich, played by Sean Bean. There is this kind of, you know, that was the time of the Blackadder as well, and then Tim McInerney pops up as Hod. There isn't that sort of parody in your film. It's quite serious.
Yeah, it's weird. As soon as you burn a witch, you know it's Monty Python, and as soon as Tim turned up, there was that fear that I didn't have, my generation didn't have. I know we all know what a great actor Tim is, but we shot the film in order, so we're all on the road traveling towards this village, and then the first person you see is Tim. And yet Tim plays it so differently that it's that feeling of him's gone completely. But
no,
it's true.
Absolutely.
There is that fear. But Tim, weirdly, Tim got involved in the project, and his part was quite small to begin with. And I said, look, Tim, I don't want the number two guy to be a kind of just a goon. I want him to be like a Himmler, to Hitler. I want him to be the kind of brains in the operation. And so Tim kind of expanded that part himself. And
Right, because he's the sort of, you know, the number two in this village, yeah, which has been preserved from the plague. And you know, it's full of flaxen head wenches. It looks a nice place to be. But it becomes an examination of sort of early Christianity versus paganism and the kind of role of God in all this. And I was thinking, well, this is quite sort of interesting stuff. You know, it doesn't mean that your previous films weren't interesting.
But it
did seem that, you know, you'd almost toned it down. I was expecting it, because it's a Chris Smith movie, I was expecting a bit more kind of blood, a bit more gore, I was expecting a bit more breasts in it as well.
Yeah, well, it's very brutal. I mean, I can only apologise for the breasts. I did try to...
The lack of breasts,
yeah. I did, you know, there's a rebirth scene where the girls are all stood around and they're like maidens that are helping Langiva the witch as she's doing this rebirth scene. And clearly they could have been naked, kind of in the style of The Wicker Man. And I just felt it would have been wrong. But weirdly, after I'd finished the movie, I came up with a brilliant idea of how I could have done it. I could have had it about sexual guilt that the monk's going through for going to see the thing. And then it would have worked.
Because he's having sex. This is the point with the monk.
Right.
He's wrestling
he's
dallying.
He's a dirty monk. Yeah, he
isn't
is.
He?
And he's in conflict with the idea of, can I be a Christian and be in love with a woman? And the church is saying no. He has his own ideas on that. And then when he goes off on the road, he starts to think that maybe God's punishing him specifically for his...
Now, you've got a nice bunch of, I suppose, redoubtable British character actors to play your kind of, you know, hobbledehoy knights who haven't had a bath since the Battle of Cressy. it must have been great fun making this, or is it hard work? Because I mean, obviously the weather's hard because you're tracing through marshes and kind of got glens and all that sort of stuff. But it did look kind of a lot of love. John Lynch, I think, is a really good character actor.
Yeah, he's brilliant. It was. I mean, I had more of a worry. When you put a group of guys together, you always get that fear that they're all going to be trying to get the biggest sword and all that. You're all going to be picking the biggest sword. And that was an early concern. And we had a scene where, you know, I had to lay all the swords out and everybody gets to pick their sword. And so I did this thing where, depending on what your star was on the IMDb, you know, whoever's the biggest star gets to pick first. So Sean got to pick the biggest sword. But he didn't actually pick the biggest sword. He picked the kind of most stylish one. And then it went all the way down the line until the guys who had the least credits.
That would have been a nice scene. Being the day that Sean Bean went, I love that one.
That's what he did. He's like, oh, I think I love that nice one there. He's very quiet. But then as soon as we started filming, it all kind of, that fear that I had that everyone was going to be trying to get the most lines and be the biggest star, it totally disappeared. And everybody kind of followed, you know, a real discipline. So it was a lot of fun. And also it was very focused. I mean, the film I'd done before, you know, Severance, was a lot of fun to make and kind of very unfocused, but lots of fun.
It was a right giggle.
Yeah, it was a giggle. This one was the same sort of love on set, if you like, but with a... You know, with a real focus.
With a film like this, do you do much research? I mean, in a way that you could, you know, we mentioned some of those films which were under general, and you could go back to that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Could you go back to it vaguely, or do you really feel that you have to kind of immerse yourself in research at the time?
Yeah, I did a lot of research on the actual plague itself and how the plague came about. I mean, it didn't just arrive on the shores of England unannounced. Because people did a lot more travel in those days than we kind of thought they would, people had heard that there was this terrible plague in Europe that was coming our way. So there was this general anxiety. But the problem is, when you're filming history, do you give someone exactly how it is, or do you give it how it is, but with a little smidgen of what you hope it will be like as well?
Yeah.
So I had to give you that kind of little element of making it feel grubby and darker.
Because they were almost like one of those movies where the survivors break away from the kind of alien invasion, or from the plague, or from the kind of, what was that one recently, the crazes, where, you know, there's people going on that. And, you know, and it could be SARS or whatever it is these days. There's always some disease where there's like, and they turn around and someone's got it, you know, someone in the group, and they haven't told us.
Yeah,
you know,
which is what we've got.
But that happens in the modern kind of sci-fi. Kind of a great, it's actually kind of made a lot of sense with the plague. I mean, it actually makes more sense doing it with the plague than it does with some of this kind of sci-fi to me.
Well, I think the fact that it's 600 years ago and then you see all the parallels now with the disease and the kind of the idea of fundamentalism and all that stuff, I think is really interesting in the film. But yeah, it's weird, I think, when you put a group of guys together and you walk them through medieval England, you kind of, how far do you go? How many boils do you show? There are so many stories that you hear from that period where, you know, the way they would think that you could cure the thing by putting a chicken's backside on the boil and that will...
Doesn't that work?
It doesn't work, no.
And
there we are, I know. So there I am.
My
on
grandma
the
still tries that with zits.
I'm on the edge of Monty Python the whole time, and these are some of the things that I'd like to do. So when you say, I'm surprised that Chris Smith didn't have more of this or more of that, I needed to be, I think, show some restraint, because the period would have turned into Carry On, you know, Black Death if I hadn't, because if I let myself off my lead entirely. I mean, in fairness, though...
That's because you're always, as I said, because Severance is, you know, is really funny, you know, and that's a difficult film to actually, you know, that was almost dangerous to be funny with, because it's that kind of, it's a thriller in a way.
Yeah.
But you have a lot of laughs with it.
I mean, in fairness, there's a lot of killing in it. Sean does get have a moment where he's tied between two horses.
Yeah, that's quite harsh.
Yeah, it just doesn't play for titillation. It plays for kind of serious. That's
yeah,
what it does,
and I mean, I there were lots of things in it that I really liked. I liked the design of it. I was very impressed with it. No, I wasn't expecting it to be rubbish, Chris. Don't worry. But I was sort of impressed with the restraint, but rather surprised by it. And it was a sober examination of a time, and it made me think about that period, because I do think that it has been kind of optioned, if you like, by parody at the Middle Ages.
Yeah, you can think of The Name of the Rose, a film called The Navigator. There aren't many movies that deal with that period in a serious way. So in this film, it was, I'm doing those things, but we're doing it with a kind of a moodier...
Does this signal a moodier Chris Smith then?
Well, I think the next film I'm going to do is going to be funny, actually.
It's going to have breasts in it.
Yeah, it's going to have breasts in it, and it'll be funny, because I do like to... I mean, I feel like... I didn't feel like I was in any way restrained in this film. I wasn't, but... because I felt it was serious. I'd say that the truth of the matter is that when you look at historical drama, it's that thing Woody Allen said, that comedy is tragedy plus time. So it's as though you can just do anything as long as there's 100 years separating it. You can make a love story on Titanic. It's okay, it's 100 years ago. Yeah, I approached it as though this was a tragedy that happened to real people, so I give it a bit of respect.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because I think that there's a school of British directors where people get accepted into Cannes competition, the Loach, the Lees, and all that, and then there's the younger social realists and all that, and you're carving out a very interesting career for yourself, as we say, in a genre kind of manner, and very profitable. Your films make some money, we hope, and there's you and Neil Marshall and sort of Nick Love, and they kind of you're there and you want a commercial success with your film. Is that almost a harder way to do it? Because you're on your own, really. You're not kind of part of the Film Council or Film Four don't give you that backing. You're not nurtured as artists. Does that piss you off? Or do you just think, well, I'm going to get on with it and make a load of money and say, bugger you lot?
Yeah, I think that the films that we're trying to do are actually more like an American model. In America, there's no shame in making a film that's successful. And here, there's a little bit of a kind of... there's that feeling that it's got to be more highbrow, but I don't think that comes down upon us. I think the support I get from the industry is still there, and I think that people, we all like movies that one or two things: either it's a critical success or it's a commercial success or both. And obviously it's lovely for a filmmaker when you get good reviews and it, but it's also lovely when you get the box office, so you've got to try and get both, really.
Yeah, well, I wish you the best of luck at the box office. I know there's a World Cup going on at the moment. Your Knights would do quite well in the World Cup.
Have you released it on the same weekend as the World Cup?
Yes. I don't mean to say. I hope it rains.
No, I think it'll be. Yeah, I think it's gonna. I think that I think Saturday evening might be a quiet night, but hopefully the rest of the weekend.
When that World Cup draw came out and you released it,
damn it!
Man. Of all things, England. It was the French. All your Knights hate the French.
I know. They love the French. That's a good thing. There's lots of anti-French jokes, which are quite funny. Yeah.
Chris Smith, I wish you the best of luck with Black Death and your future film.
Thanks very much.
With more breasts.
Thanks. I promise.
I love a film that gives you the excuse to use the word necromancers. Chris Smith's Black Death is on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 11th of June. From the Black Death to the Kiss of Death, and Zan Brooks joins me in the studio to review some of this week's films.
There'll be no kissing going on this week.
Oh, good. Even in Greenberg, which stars Ben Stiller and Greta Gerwig, having an awkward romantic encounter, Zan, let's go to Los Angeles, where Roger Greenberg is trying to get it on with Florence, who works for his brother. It's all very complicated, especially when Florence is one of those indie girls for whom sex is not an easy issue.
Can we take it slow? I'm sorry, it's just that... I just got out of a long relationship, and I don't want to go from just having sex to just having sex to just having sex.
Who's the third just having sex?
You, if we had sex.
Okay, then who's the second?
A guy I met at this gallery thing.
You slept with him?
Yeah, I did.
How'd that go?
What do you mean, the sex?
Yeah, well...
It's pretty awkward.
Ben Stiller there, toning down the comedy for a kind of more serious look at psychosis in Greenberg. Is this the sort of indie styling that you like? Noah Baumbach, who did The Squid and the Whale, here he is in LA, from New York to LA.
Yeah, I met up with Ben Stiller a couple of years back, and he said that he was going to go dark, that he was sick of the comedy and he was now going to go dark. And I guess this is sort of what he meant.
Yeah, I'm sick of his comedy as well.
Oh, you were, weren't you? Yeah. You hated Tropic Thunder.
Yeah,
so you prefer him in this.
Yes, I did, much.
Yeah, I think he's really good in this. And I actually think he's at his best when there's that sort of anger and that neurosis is to the fore. That's why the Stiller films I really like are things like Flirting with Disaster and maybe Meet the Parents.
Cable Guy,
where he's pent up and full of rage, like his dad in Seinfeld.
Like he actually is.
Absolutely. He's a twisted bag of neurosis is Stiller, I think. And this plays to all of that, and it's a midlife crisis drama. He's a former musician who has to look after his wealthy brother's LA pad and look after his dog, and sort of, I guess, still dreams of stardom when actually all that sort of turned to dust.
Used to be in a band, didn't they? It turns out he used to be in a band with Reese Ifans, and he walked out on them because he didn't like the recording contract, and they obviously went off to New York and had a very neurotic life there.
Yeah, he's your classic American male in crisis, totally self-destructive. Bright, but so full of prickles and thorns that people eventually recoil.
Yeah, kind of weird too. I mean, kind of like he looks like the guy he played in the Royal Tannenbaums.
Yes,
that guy, but slightly grown up because he's still got the sort of hair like a tennis pro.
He's got the hair that's would suit a younger man, isn't it? Yeah. And he's still kind of clinging on to that. And his relationship with the Greta Gerwig character is your classic. It's not sort of May to December, but it's you're not sure whether he really loves her for her or whether it's just another way of clinging on to his youth.
Right, so he starts up this relationship with, I suppose she sees his brother's assistant,
yeah,
who's looking after the house. She's one of those kind of classic kind of indie film constructs, and she's a little bit dippy, she's a little bit, oh my God, I'm going to stick with you, but I also sing. She's one of those girls. Do you like those sort of girls in films, or do they annoy the hell out of you?
I think a little bit of both, and therein lies the appeal, isn't it? It's a fine line, and she is the queen of mumblecore, isn't she, Greta Gerwig? And whether you or not you like mumblecore, she certainly is. You don't, do you?
Not normally. Although I quite like We Like Beeswax. We had Andrew Bujalski on the phone the other week.
I quite like it, and I quite like her. And
I do too.
I think that the mumblecore vibe is actually, you know, seep through to infect Noah Baumbach a bit, because, you know, his previous two films, The Squid and the Whale and Margot at the Wedding, were slightly more formal and composed, even though they're exactly as literate and had the same sort of screwed up protagonists in them. Whereas this one feels a bit more loose limbed, and it's a series of little miniatures, really, but it does add up.
He's married to Jennifer Jason Leigh, who makes an appearance in here. I mean, Margot at the Wedding, which I think everyone sort of seemed to hate, I really liked
that. Yeah, I didn't
mind
it at all.
Jack Black and Nicole Kidman and Jennifer Jason Leigh, big cast, I think, because it had these people in it, people went to see it and they thought, oh my God, it's going to be like Moulin Rouge meets School of Rock. But it wasn't as much more kind of angsty than that. So I don't know why people get kind of upset with Baumbach. I think he's quite an interesting filmmaker. A lot of people find this one sort of a little bit navel-gazy and kind of inward. But it's about an
inward-directed, navel-gazing, dislikable
character. Go figure. Yeah, I liked it. Deadpan,
funny. I like these characters, you know.
Yeah, I don't know why.
It's like us.
Isn't he just? Greenberg, Schmienberg, Zan. Let's talk about a documentary now, H2 Oil. Anyone who has listened to Film Weekly the last couple of months will know about the Alberta tar sands, a huge excavation up in Canada, the size of England, leaving a great scar on the landscape of Canada.
Covering 149,000 square kilometres, an area larger than England. Cranes and 400-ton trucks haul the bitumen off to extraction plants where, in order to separate the sand from the bitumen, it is mixed with large amounts of fresh water heated by natural gas. It is then spun with a chemical solvent to further remove clay and minerals, leaving the remaining wastewater to be dumped into enormous toxic tailings ponds. The siphoned off bitumen is then sent into pipelines to be processed into crude oil throughout North America.
Zan, that's a clip from H2 Oil, a film about the Alberta tar sands. Did you know about the Alberta tar sands?
I had a weird little Groundhog Day moment when I sat down to watch this, and I thought, this is exactly the same film that I saw 2 months ago. But then I realised that one was called Dirty Oil. In between these two films, there's been another film called Petropolis.
I saw that one too.
Which is about the same thing. I wonder if these camera crews are all sort of banging into each other.
There must be. It's the busiest place other than the Antarctic. It's the only other place that's so full of film crews.
There's there's a character on this, one of the activists, who says that the whole tar sand excavation is the largest unsustainable development on this planet. So I guess now we've got the largest unsustainable development to show the largest unsustainable development.
I worry. This is clearly a very bad thing, the Alberta tar sands, unless you're an oil mogul.
Presumably it's still going on, though, because they're still making these films.
Yeah, I presume so. And I'm not sure that these films have kind of built up enough of an audience to, that we could all kind of picket the area and stop it. You and I have certainly seen it. We think it's a bad thing, because aren't they there? There are kind of indigenous communities way downriver who are kind of getting cancer and all this. And we've seen a lot of them. I mean, there's every single one, they're very small communities. They keep saying we're such a small community. Well, but I've seen most of them on film so far.
Yes, of course, it's a terrible issue. They're running through fresh water supplies. It takes something like 5 barrels of fresh water to make 1 barrel of crude oil. The runoff is then dumped into the river. So you've got like loads of arsenic in the river.
It's not supposed to be dumped into the river. It's supposed to go into these tailgates, but these
leak. They leak. They leak, Jason. And so the cancer rates are sky high. Do we need to be told it 3 times? I guess the people behind this, this series of films, the cooperative, this is their tar sands trilogy, would say yes, we do.
Yeah, it's
we do need to be told it again and again.
Being released by a UK distributor whose balls I have, my Dogwoof, who but they've really got their Dogwoof with a bone here, and I would just, maybe it's time to kind of let go, right? Because I'm aware of it, but maybe, you know, I think they need to convince other people. That's why we're talking about it here. Because if you're out there and you haven't seen any of these, maybe go and see these films or find out about the tar sands. There's a lot of it on YouTube, and some of these films are quite beautiful. I must say that. The aerial photography is...
Yeah, I did worry about the various planes crashing into each other, though, as they were getting these aerial shots. But I guess, I mean, their argument would be, even if people aren't seeing these 3 films, the fact that we're talking about it, the fact that the newspapers are on a bound to even do, like, you know, a line or two, it's getting the message across.
Yeah.
So we're playing our part here.
That's good. I don't know what you're going to do about it, because there's a right big hole in the middle of Canada. So it's going to replace your divot. Seems to be a slightly very difficult task.
Well, you know, you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you about one film and you can tell me about another. You can start with Brooklyn's Finest, because it's got stars in it, Zan. And it's the film by Antoine Fuqua about corrupt cops, starring Richard Gere and Ethan Hawke.
Here's the deal. Our commissioner... He believes in this new program that puts rookie cops in the highest crime areas. So they want seasoned hairbags like you breaking these recruits in. And since you're the oldest here...
Look, if it's all the same to you, I got 7 days. I'm no one's teacher. I'm not a role model.
God knows you're not, Eddie. But your name came up in a computer, pal.
Cops, corrupt cop. I love corrupt cop dramas, but I like this one.
You'll love this one then, Jason, because this is basically 3 corrupt cop dramas in one.
Oh, fantastic.
Or to view it less charitably, it's 3 cliched cop dramas for the price of one.
The Wire, for example, is very popular. I mean, is this tapping into that Wire?
I suppose it is. It's also, doffing its cap to another Antoine Fuqua film from a couple of years ago, that Training Day, that won the Oscar for...
Did that not have Ethan Hawke
again, reprising his role Assaults. Although here he plays someone called Sal, a narcotics agent called Sal.
Oh no, a man.
A man. But whether it's a girl or a Latino, Ethan Hawke isn't your obvious Sal.
I think Ethan Hawke's rubbish.
He's not overly convincing in this. He's got the tattoos, but he
doesn't. Ethan Hawke's got tattoos.
Yeah.
Oh come on.
And quite a buff physique.
Oh, don't
as well.
Be ridiculous.
And so he's the cop who's sort of bending the rules because he's got 7 kids at home.
He's got seven kids. Ridiculous.
You don't believe you don't
no,
believe
he left
anything
Uma
about
no,
this.
No, I don't. He's a man who was married to Uma Thurman and screwed it up. I've got nothing to say.
You've
to
got
him.
No respect for a man
Idiot.
Such as that.
Yeah.
Well, here you'll have less respect for him. So he's rattling around in this house that's got the mould in the walls, and his wife has got the asthma. So he's lifting money from dealers.
You've got to take a bit off the top, cream a bit off the bottom.
Absolutely.
You know that. You wouldn't be a good cop if you didn't.
You know the cop highway code, don't you? You've also got Don Cheadle as Tango.
Oh, no, I like Tango as in Tango in Cash.
No, it's not. It might as well be, but it's not. He's his own Tango. He's a sort of undercover brother who's has to dob in his former best mate, who's a drug dealer out of prison and trying to go straight.
Right, it's a tough
So that's the second cliche. And then the third cliche, of course, you've got Richard Gere as the grizzled, boozy old officer who's got one last week before his retirement.
Oh, really? Is he not asked? Or just is he just going to cream that little bit more off the top?
He just doesn't know what to do. On the one hand, he wants to serve out his time and then throw his badge on the desk.
Of course. But on the other... Buying a fishing boat. Is he buying a fishing
boat? Yeah, of course he's buying a fishing boat. But on the other, you know, what is he to make of his life? He's got to do something big and maybe redeem himself. You see, and it's all here.
With one last kind of...
One last job.
Double cross.
One last job.
A job that is an illegal job.
No, he's got to do something good for once.
Oh, I see. Because he was in internal affairs and he got investigated. He's got a copy, a rap sheet the size of my dick.
Let's not go into how like the comparative. I mean,
obviously, I really haven't seen this.
You're
film.
Loving this, aren't you?
But it does. I mean, it's very long. I notice, and I quite like Antoine Fuqua. I think he's kind of an interesting African American director, kind of directing very highly in the mainstream. This doesn't seem to be furthering any reputations for anyone, even for the genre itself.
Not at all. It's like your karaoke cop drama. As soon as it starts, you basically sing your way through it all, and it ends up with the big bloodbath. Some characters are doomed to fall, and some might just get out alive.
Oh, don't tell me!
I'm not going to tell you, Jason, but see if you can guess.
Oh dear! Oh, shame about Richard Gere as well.
Tell me about your film,
Zan. I should tell you about Shed Your Tears and Walk Away, which is a very change of pace and not cliched at all. I've never seen a film like this at all. We had actually the director Jez Lewis on the show around the time of the London Film Festival when this film kind of premiered in the documentary section, and it's a tremendously sad film. He comes from Hebden Bridge, a very picturesque town.
I like Hebden Bridge.
You've been there, have you?
I have.
Is it literary festivals and that sort of thing?
No. This was just me being the southern tourist going up to Hebden Bridge because the scenery around there is very beautiful.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's a beautiful town.
Well, perhaps you can explain why, if it's such a picturesque village, that so many of Jez Lewis's colleagues and school friends and childhood friends have fallen prey to drug addictions and suicide. He just goes into these kind of, you know, the very troubled lives that they have there. And we come up with some very sort of sad lives that we're just taken into.
Presumably it's a mill, or it was a mill town, and now that's sort of gone.
That industry is gone. So another industry for it now is the kind of artisan and chocolates and kind of the tourists and the kind of, you know, Zanbrooks, please come up for your weekend kind of thing, and three-star bed and breakfast.
I couldn't afford Hebden Bridge.
But I mean, it is kind of baffling, but he does, it's a very, because he's from there and sort of abandoned it years ago to come down to London, he goes back and there are people who he obviously knows very well. And it's a very sort of unsentimental documentary, which is why, like, it's very empathetic simply because he's friends with these guys. And these are the people you probably might have seen on your little kind of visit, but they're the guys with the dogs on strings in the park who are kind of on tenants extra at 3 and three, you know, 12 and the 11s, if you like. So while you're in your tea shops, they're there. I found this a very moving kind of journey home, a very personal film. It's called Shed Your Tears and Walk Away. I couldn't say it's a date movie. I couldn't say, like, go see, because it's one of the, but it's a tremendously kind of moving kind of experience to be taken among these people, and almost a privilege in a way, because there's no way you'd get amongst them unless you were Jez Lewis or Jez Lewis's camera, which for the duration of Shed Your Tears and Walk Away, we are. Thank you, Zan, for the best film news and reviews, for lots of Zan, and for lots of coverage of the upcoming Edinburgh International Film Festival. Go to guardian.co.uk/film. Now, maybe it's because I'm a Londoner. I'm often asked to name what I regard as my great London movies, and I invariably name-check a film called Bronco Bullfrog from 1970, more often than not to a bemused look. So it's with great joy that Bronco Bullfrog is this week back on the big screen in a pristine new print. And it's also a delight that its director, Barney Platt-Mills, is still a vociferous advocate for this work and his style of filmmaking. I met up with Barney at the BFI South Bank recently and started out by suggesting to him that his film is probably getting a bigger re-release now than it had got in the first place. Before we hear what Barney has to say about that, let's go back to the East End, 1970, and Bronco Bullfrog.
Is your daughter in, please?
Which one?
Oh, she's about that way. Slim, with the long hair.
Well, who are you?
Let the Ripper.
Don't be saucy.
Well, no, it got a big release. It got 200 cinemas in 1970. And that's the curious thing about it, that it's allowed itself to disappear.
That's right. So let's take me back to the East End in 1970. I mean, it was presumably still a kind of craze hunting ground, which a lot of people would have said that's why they don't go there.
Yeah, Exactly. It was not a hunting ground. It was their, that's why they had
manor.
Their manor. And they were serious about that. They felt they were in charge, and that's why they got put down quite so heavily, I think. Because they were seriously saying the police didn't have authority around here.
But you were down there because of Jo Littlewood, really?
Yes, she had her Theatre Royal at Stratford there. I was asked to work for her, making a film, trying to make a film about her. I mean, I wasn't trying to make the film, I was meant to be editing a film that Walter Lasserly was shooting about the Fun Palace concept, which was the idea of the Lee Valley being turned over to fun for everyone, and that was her idea. And we were trying to make a film on that, but really we didn't get very far, I'm afraid. But I then got the funding to make a film about her, or a workshop that she'd set up next to the Theatre Royal for the local kids. And that's where I started work, really, with these boys, with Sam and Roy and Del.
And how young were they at the time?
They were 15, 16, weren't they? They just got out of school, you know, and they just started apprenticeships. Well, most of them had apprenticeships, which in jobs which they've stuck at ever since.
And they would visit Joan Littlewood's school in the evening class?
Just to have something to do, somewhere to go, and that's why they were there, and they'd hang out. And when she was there, they'd have great, you know, dramatic events. And, you know, she taught them drama, and no questions. They learnt to enjoy it and learnt to think this is something to do, you know, something to better than hanging around the streets.
Yeah. The filmmaking style of the time, did that allow you to kind of get that theatricality in it, or did you have to sort of take it down a bit because it's film and acting is a bit smaller on film?
Yes, they had to be much more controlled, obviously. They were all terribly well-behaved and well, you know, they got this idea of their nose mustn't move. We're in close-up, you mustn't move your nose. You can do what you like. Your nose better stay put.
Yeah.
And they knew how to do that quite quickly. Mm. And so, well, I mean, somehow to get into film, well, no, I always was trying to surprise them a bit, you know, to keep them alive. That's
That certainly comes across. I don't know how much of the script you'd worked out beforehand.
There was a script, and every time you'd say, look, here's the words, and some of them wanted to use the words, and that's it, they wouldn't depart from that. And others on said, I can't be bothered with that, Barney. And they did something which was along those lines and was better, or was what we got anyway.
Was there an occasion where they sort of say, well, we wouldn't say that, you know, our characters part wouldn't say that?
But that was rather before, because we'd discussed that before the script was written about. And yes, certainly, all the time, if there's something they wouldn't say that. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's what you pay, the price you pay for trying to get life into your film, the accident of life, is you don't have that virtue of writing your wonderful lines, and gosh, they're much more important than anything you've got to say.
Mm. The film is an interesting kind of concept. Where did you get the idea for the film? Did you know, as you say, you thought, well, I'll work with Jones' kind of troupe, if you like. That was your starting point. How did you then think, well, what story can I make with these people?
The story had come to me several years before, when a kid had come to our house saying he'd got his girlfriend with him and they were on the run, you know, because she was only 15 and he was 16. And this is a crime, you know, Romeo and Juliet or what?
Mm.
And I just thought that was outrageous. And I wrote a sort of script then about it. And then adapted that story to these boys' situation when they said I should make a proper film, because we'd been messing around with this documentary we're making, and they said, why don't you make a proper film, Barney? So we tried. I wrote a script, and as I say, then they had the choice to use the script or not.
What do you think, yeah, given that the freneticism of today's life and freneticism of today's videos, cinema, culture, watching it on YouTube, what do you think? I mean, this is very much a teen movie as well. One could put it in that kind of bracket. What do you think today's teenagers would make of this film?
Well, this is what I hope to find. I think it's so sad that it's not available to young people or everyone. You know, it's not available to people because I'm quite sure a lot of people, well, I know a lot of people find it very engaging. You know.
I think they'd completely appreciate the sort of alienation that these kids feel. I mean, you don't overstate it, which is why I like the movie. They kind of go, this up west has really got nothing for us.
Yeah, exactly.
I think people will still feel that.
And also, the shyness of young love.
And just finally, the name, Bronco Bullfrog, where did that come to you from?
It was them. They had a hero called Bronco Bullfrog. Bronco after Bronco Lane, the series on television, which you might not have remembered. Bronco Lane and Bullfrog, because he looked like a bullfrog. And they spoke of this boy as being their hero. He was away in jail, or he was in Borstal. Anyway, he wasn't around. I never met him, but certainly he was their hero. So I thought, and I like them. You know, it's a name that the distributors tried to change into Around Angel Lane, they wanted to call it. But I really put my foot down. That's where I, you know, fell out with them. I said, you know, you can stuff it if you're going to call it Around Angel Lane. I'm not playing. So we stayed with Bronco Bullfrog, which is embarrassing, really, because it's, you know, it's not obvious the kind of film you're getting, is it? People thought it was a children's film. And I thought that's part of the pleasure, really, of the critics all have to write about Bronco Bullfrog. What does it mean? You know?
I think it sounds great. It sounds like one of those names that you say in the playground, you know?
Yeah.
Or like British Bulldog. Name. It reminds me of that.
Yeah, it is. It's a playground name. Yeah. Absolutely.
Lovely. Well, it's more than a playground film, I have to say. And it now gets a large playground to play on yet again here at the BFI and then moving around the country as if on the run itself. Barney Platts-Mills, always a pleasure to see you because it means that Bronco Bullfrog. Oh, why did you have come up with that title? Bronco Bullfrog is back. Barney Platts-Mills, you are too. Nice to see you.
Very pleasant to see you again, Jason.
Spruced up and looking in its prime, Bronco Bullfrog goes on tour around the country on the back of a moped from the BFI all this month. Go to the BFI website, bfi.org.uk, for more information. That's all for this week. Thanks to my guests, Chris Smith and Barney Platts-Mills. The music you've been listening to on this week's show is from the soundtrack to Greenberg, featuring LCD Sound System, amongst many others, and well worth checking out. But until next week, when I'll be in Edinburgh, from me, Jason Solomons, and from Film Weekly's producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.